Tiny Talk, Episode 8. In this episode, interview with Amberl. Hello, and welcome to Tiny Talk, a podcast about mushes and other text-based virtual worlds. I'm your host, Javelin, and today I have a one-segment podcast to present to you. I'm about to go out of the country to teach for a week in Karachi, Pakistan, but I wanted to leave you with something to listen to before I go, and we'll have another episode in a couple of weeks once I'm back. So, Lydia Leong, better known to many mush players as Amberl, has a long and storied history in mushing. She has been the developer of several servers, including PenMush and TinyMush 2 and 3. She has run several notable mushes, and was also the author of Amberl's Mush Manual, a very popular manual for teaching people soft code. For the listeners who may not have had the pleasure of speaking with you before, perhaps you could give us a little of your personal mushing history. When and how did you start mushing, and how did you come to be involved in mush development?
I started playing all the way at the beginning of 1991, so I've been playing for just about exactly half of my lifetime now. I was sitting around right before the start of winter term in college, and at the time, I ended up sifting through the Rec Games MUD Usenet news group because some of my friends were actually on LP MUDs, and I saw an ad for a place called Fort Weir Mush, which eventually turned into Pern Mush. I logged in and was pretty much instantly addicted.
So that sounds like a familiar story. How did you go from being the addicted player to being a developer and working on the back end?
Well, about a year later, a guy who was playing Pern Mush, a fellow named Justin Harvey, was trying to start a game based on David Edding's The Bulgariad novels. And he needed some help. He was specifically needing someone who was a competent enough sysadmin to be able to deal with getting the server set up and helping him code and so forth. And he persuaded me to do it. Because of that, once I started working on code, I realized here are these things that I wanted to be able to do that the server wouldn't let me do. I did something that at the time I discovered was incredibly stupid, which is I printed out the source, which was about, at the time, around 20,000 lines. And I was not quite aware of how much paper there was going to be. And I took the gigantic stack of paper home with me for Christmas break. Ended up writing a lot of my first modifications entirely in pencil on a bunch of hard copies. Came back at the end of Christmas break, typed it in, and discovered that most of it didn't work. And that is essentially how I also ended up learning how to write C. So it was an interesting experience. It was very educational, and much of my early code is no good at all.
That's really spooky, because I actually, maybe a month or two ago, found my printouts of the source code of PenMush before it was really even called that, back when I started looking at the C as well. So it surprises me, but I guess that's a common way that people start out, as you say, oh, let's see how long this is if we print it out, right?
And then you imitate, the way things have been done, not necessarily knowing whether or not they were the right things. Right. And over time, you end up cleaning up the old mistakes and whatnot. But I mean, even at this point, as I do server work, I still find old bugs.
Now, is system administration still your real career?
Nope. I left systems administration actually quite a number of years ago. I decided that what I prefer to do was essentially marketing and consulting. So not doing system administration means not carrying a pager, which means getting to sleep, which is a magnificent thing.
Well, that's definitely a high priority thing. Now, you've spent the last couple of years away from Mush, and now that you are coming back, I wonder if you've noticed any changes either in the Mush community or in yourself as a Mush player, administrator, and so forth.
Well, I took a break of probably about 6 years. I played sort of a few things here and there, but not really very seriously. And I kept social mushing because most of my friends essentially use that rather than Instant Messenger to communicate. But I sort of lost touch with what was really going on in the community. I'm still, at this point, I would think still trying to get back in touch. I think the community is much more fragmented than it was, let's say, 10 years ago. Fewer people really know each other. The community forums aren't frequented the same way that, you know, something like Rec Games Mud Tiny once was. People know people within their own sort of, you know, little genre, but not necessarily broadly beyond that. And then, of course, there's the fragmentation between the three servers as well.
Well, speaking of servers, I was asking around, you know, hey, I'm going to talk to Ambril tonight. Is there anything you want to ask? And someone did want me to ask you what the current status is of the Tiny Mush 3 server.
Well, Tiny Mush 3 now has a new principal maintainer, Eddie Buper, who's been who's put out some number of releases and started working on Tiny Mush 3.2 Alpha. At this point, now that I'm actually working on a game again, I've started committing fixes and new features and so forth into the CVS repository. So if people want to see what I've been messing with there, they can go check out SourceForge.
Cool. So now on to the kind of what's most interesting to me, which is this new game that you're starting. Is there anything you can tell us about it?
Sure. It is actually another game based on Roger Zelazny's Amber novels. It actually picks up midway through the novels, and we're throwing out the later novels in order to be able to sort of build our own world around the same core set of names and principles and so forth, without having to be tied to an existing story.
The later novels being the ones with Merlin and the Courts of Chaos and so forth.
Yep. We're actually picking up at the end of Guns of Avalon, which is the second book, which ends with Dora, who turns out to be kind of a villain in the novels, walking the pattern and telling Corwin Amber is about to be Amber will be destroyed, and so we figure that's a good dramatic opening for the game. Eric is just about on his deathbed, things are kind of in chaos. There's the Black Road, but no one is entirely certain where it leads. We figured that this was a place where there were a lot of mysteries still left to be looked at. It will allow people to do a lot more invention rather than sort of being stuck with what's currently, you know, a part of the established 10 books and short stories.
Are there any kind of conscious game design decisions you're making this time around that are different from things you've done in the past?
Mm-hmm. So I've done a game based on Zelazny's Amber before, as well as I was a wizard on the original Amber Mush for a while. And so each time things turn out very differently. I'm trying to correct some of the mistakes that I made with my last game, which was called Blood of Amber. I ended up designing for that a deep, intricate role-playing system that was, I think, so complex that really everybody was way too intimidated to actually use it. Sure. This time, I think I'm striving for simplicity. I'm striving for no numbers or as close to no numbers as possible. At the moment, it looks like what we're aiming for is kind of a structured conflict negotiation system, which is in a lot of ways inspired by a little independent role-playing game called Polaris. Where as you talk through a conflict, it is very much a matter of using language in formal ways. I can make a statement about what I want the consequences of this encounter to be, and the other person can accept it and counter with, I want to be able to break your arm, and the other person can say okay, but only if I get to break your arm, and. So you have words like "but only if" and "alternatively" and "no, but instead," or even eventually, "you go too far," and which really says, we don't think we can resolve this on our own. We need a GM to intervene. And what we hope is that it's going to essentially create kind of a contract for the way you negotiate, a real formal way of saying, these are the things that I've agreed to, because we want things to change, right? So a lot of times if two players on a mush get into a fight in character, nothing really changes. Somebody might walk away with an injury, but injuries tend to be no fun to play. And so people will generally do whatever they can, essentially to heal from that injury as quickly as possible. There are no real lasting consequences. The fight is not necessarily about anything. What we want is for formal conflicts to be about something, for something to change. We think that in the end, conflict drives change really across the board. Conflict drives people to make choices. Conflict gives characters a chance to grow. So what we really want to push is the idea that characters own things, place them at risk, and then risk them. or the characters own things, place them at risk, and they can be taken away, destroyed, you know, affected in a variety of ways. There's something that's worth fighting for, essentially. And whether that fight is a physical one or it's a conflict about NPCs, between kingdoms, anything along those lines. We want to support something that's relatively broad, and that allows a pretty large range of character concepts, so that characters, for instance, who are politically oriented, don't have kind of the sheet disadvantages to combat characters necessarily.
Wow, that's really interesting. That kind of engagement and involvement, I know, for many people, is what really makes the game, as it were. You mentioned Polaris, and it seems to me a burgeoning interest in kind of indie role playing games and their application to online worlds. Was that a choice that you made because you'd been playing Polaris, or just sort of reading about it, or how did that come to pass?
It was actually a suggestion made by one of the wizards of the bunch of people who are working on this game. Two of them are the principals for Evil Hat. Evil Hat being a little independent games company that's done probably two games that have gotten quite a bit of buzz recently: Fate and also a game called Spirit of the Century, which is Fate based. It's a pulp role playing game set at the beginning of the 20th century.
Didn't they also do Don't Rest Your Head?
And then Don't Rest Your Head. Yep.
Okay.
Exactly. So I think that the things that have been big in the indie community the last couple of years have driven a lot of our thinking here. And it's very much about light system, about wordless system, about system that's or numberless systems, rather, systems that are frequently diceless, and that systems that are really about sort of narrative consequences as opposed to, you know, hit points.
And do you have any estimated time when your mush will open?
I don't at the moment. We're hoping that we're going to be opening for building in around a week or two. But I think actually getting fully opened is going to depend heavily upon how quickly people build, how quickly we can get some code systems done, how busy I end up being at work.
And does it have a name?
It does. It's called currently The Road to Amber.
The Road to Amber. Excellent. You at one time were quite a strong proponent of the philosophy of objectivism, that is the Ayn Rand objectivism, and I was wondering if you still felt strongly about that, and why or why not?
Mm-hmm. I think I used to for a good number of years of college. I haven't really thought about it much in a large number of years. I think eventually what got me off the sort of the objectivism kick was the realization that the way it had been treated as a societal construct had ended up being very much as a religion unto itself, right? Something almost that was almost cult-like in its approach. I still find Rand's novels to be very interesting, but I think more as a set of thoughts than as anything that I necessarily, you know, believe per se. I think there are a lot of principles there that I still believe in pretty strongly. I believe very strongly that people essentially have control where their lives go, that it's important to create something, that the fact that someone else has created something great doesn't in any way diminish whatever you're working on. I've never been necessarily a huge fan of what I would consider to be competitive creativity. For instance, in the Mush community, like I've always solidly believed that there's lots of room for many games, many ideas, many server flavors, many different ways of approaching things.
Well, and I think from the time that I had the privilege of working with you as an administrator, I think that's one of those things that I sort of remember very strongly about your style back from Belgariad was kind of this notion that what someone else does that's great isn't really competing with what you want to do that's great, and that all of those things should be encouraged and people really should contribute.
Mm-hmm. And I think also the thing that I hope the community does more of is to share more ideas about what has worked and what hasn't worked. Games live and die for a lot of reasons, and having more ideas circulated means that ideas aren't necessarily going to be used verbatim, but people take ideas, they rework them, they use them as inspiration for other things, and hopefully, you know, over time we get what is a little bit more forward progress. You know, the community has ended up kind of graying over time, right? There's not a lot of new blood. There's definitely some, but most of the people today coming onto online gaming are playing massively multiplayer online games, right? And it means that, you know, if we don't get new blood into the hobby, right, it will eventually die out. I think probably one of the things that's really struck me coming back is, you know, everybody's married with children now. It seems to be the way of things.
Well, yeah, I guess I resemble that remark. Do you have any suggestions then about what would be some better ways to do that?
I think that things like the Penmush community portal are tremendously useful. I like to see more people share their ideas. I would love to see more people share the process of designing a game, the way, you know, they think about the way they think about structuring a game. I think that we would benefit very strongly from more code being released into the public domain, because I think probably one of the big things that still stymies a lot of game construction is the lack of a good coder. And for a long time, the Mush community kind of ate its young, right? We were we were very concerned about the quality of global code. You know, we were very concerned about the amount that people were building. People were trying to limit database sizes and so forth. And today, you know, a lot of the measures that were put into place, which made a lot of sense 10 years ago or you know, 15 years ago, make zero sense today, right? So your average Mush takes up essentially, you know, no resources on a modern computer. And there's no real reason why people shouldn't be allowed to build, shouldn't be allowed to code, et cetera. You know, for globals, people still want to tend to maintain a certain degree of quality, but you know, your average player shouldn't be getting started writing global code. They should be getting started writing code for their own little areas. And there are not a whole lot of places that really formally encourage people to build or formally encourage people to code as part of the broader Mush mission. Right? So there are places that are social mushes or kind of building oriented, but most role playing games tend to focus very strictly on the role playing aspect and not so much on anything else. So people write little bits of utility code, but the little bits of utility code tend to get passed on to a couple other players, and then people don't build their own. This contrasts pretty sharply, I think, against a place like, you know, Pardmush early on. People were doing projects, right? So you would come onto Pern and you would say be a smith, and people would write you know little objects that did a variety of things. One of my big memories from early on in Pernmush was there was a guy who was I think it was a PhD student in astronomy, and he built and he sat down and he worked out this complex model of the skies of Pern, and then he built essentially a telescope that would tell you, you know, the positions of everything and where it was related, and you know, in a relatively astronomically accurate way. Right? It was a piece of code. He did it as a project. But I think one of the key things is because people were doing projects like that, most people on the game knew how to build, and a very high percentage of them knew how to code. And over time, that kind of sort of institutional knowledge has really gone away. And you know, while a fair number of people can at least do some rudimentary building, coding has become this thing that has become this little priesthood.
All right, so we're going to keep an eye on your blog for your new game, and see what we can take from that as well in terms of open game design. Mm-hmm. Music for this episode of Tiny Talk was provided by Nesta Positive from the Nesta Positive album and Jamendo.com. If you're downloading this directly from the web, you can also subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Tiny Talk is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license, so you're welcome to share it as is, just don't sell it. Show notes for Tiny Talk are at community.penmush.org. If you have comments, mushing questions you'd like answered, or suggestions for future shows, send email to tinytalk@javelin.penmush.org. Or leave a voicemail at 206-333-1542. Until next time, keep the text flowing.